Group meeting, Saturday, 22nd November, 1986. This fear of death is a curious thing. There is the intense clinging to life, to go on and on. Life as such is eternal. There is no getting away from that fact. It is for us to wake up to the nature of its eternity. This is what we cannot do. You see, we don't appreciate the fact that right here now, there is no past, apart from the fact that the here now is the resultant of the total past, not merely one's own past, in the reincarnational sense. And in any case, that's a hopeless error. but the past of the totality, of which each one of us is an integral part and parcel. So if there is no past and there is no future in actuality here now, at this moment, because the future hasn't emerged yet. Therefore, if we can wake up to the now in its fullness, then we are conscious in the mode of eternity. This must not be mistaken for timelessness. The experience of timelessness is a human experience which begins at a certain moment when in profound meditation you enter into that very deep state, and after a period of time which may be some minutes, hours, days, up to about 6 or 7 days at most. That timelessness has to come to an end simply because whilst the body is alive, it has to eat, sleep, eliminate, and all that sort of thing. Therefore, you can't stay in the eternity which characterizes holistic consciousness all through your physical life. If you could do that, you could extend your physical life forever and ever, which really would be a tragedy. Because whether you are conscious in terms of eternity and infinity or not conscious in those terms, the duals will always be with you. Pleasure and pain, health and sickness, because that is the nature of organic existence. Those things are always there, you see. So that's where we stopped last time. We'll go on now with the uprising of separative self-consciousness, with its inevitable accompaniment of fear and conflict. Because the moment we are separatively conscious, there is ourself, the self as we call it, and all the rest of the universe is the not-self. And what every self tries to do is to master the not-self, to bend it to the will of the self. My will, not its will. And so there is perpetual conflict. The golden age of, with the uprising of separative self-consciousness, the golden age of unknowing communion in Eden's carefree delight comes to an end. Neither Adam nor Eve was born or grew or matured. There is a tremendous amount involved in that single sentence, but I won't expatiate on it now because it will take too much time. Our idea of being born, of growing and maturing, is confined to our time consciousness. If and when we realize the eternal nature of the now and are conscious in those terms, we are neither born nor grow nor mature. It's a curious thing to say, because our senses say, as a matter of fact, that of course there is that infant that is born, it is growing, and here we are ourselves, grown up, maturing, I trust, and so forth. You see? So, the mode of consciousness which is dependent upon the functioning of the senses and the synthesizing activity of the brain, making a meaningful picture of what is happening, meaningful to us, is what prevents us from understanding the deep things. They knew not time and time's infliction of selfness and striving, of anxiety and sorrow. They knew no dis-ease, but they changed the life force. The subtle serpent seduced them. See, the life force working through the particular organism makes that organism want to continue forever. It's a struggle against death. You see? But it's folly to struggle against death. Every single moment we live, die instantaneously. Because with every moment the organism is changing. That means it is dying to its previous condition. So you see, if one really considers that very carefully, and it is not easy to consider it deeply enough, but if you can do it, then you will cease to cling to life and stay and try to stave off death. You can't stave off that which is natural to the whole organic process. The wise thing is to understand it and cooperate with it. We die from each moment into the next moment. And that is actually being born in the next moment. So this birth-death pulse goes on perpetually. If one is really conscious of it, the brain by itself won't be able to make you conscious. You have to let the brain be quiet, and then you'll experience transcendentally the meaning of the eternal now. It will become a reality then. Until then it won't be real. The life force, the subtle serpent, seduced them. They began to distinguish in their conscious minds the two elements composing the pleasure-pain mechanism of their living organic being. That is, they grew in the knowledge of good and evil. What promoted organic life, judged by pleasing sensation, was good. The opposite was evil. Adam and Eve, their names represent man in his childhood long ago, feared and rejected death because they did not understand it. Life for them was only biological, So they chose pleasure by preference. The mind stored up the multitudinous impressions life made upon them, remembering the pleasant ones and trying to forget the unpleasant. But the suppressed impressions found nourishment and fruitful breeding ground in the hidden depths of the mind. That's how the shadow gets formed, you see. You know, psychologists talk about the shadow. But this suppression is what brings about the shadow. And then we associate what we suppress with other people. I am a good fellow, the other fellow is the bad fellow. And so on and so on. I am wise, the other man is foolish. Man started in the state of ignorance, unenlightened. Thank you. Unenlightened. Naturally, his dawning intelligence was incapable of right understanding. If he could have remained in a steady state of unenlightenment, free from the conflict of adaptation with adaptability, he would have remained a fixed animal species. But the possibility of exceptional development coincident with structural physical changes, especially the brain, lay within him. So, through being seduced by the life force, which is the serpent, he lost his unknowing communion and bliss, his unconscious immortality in paradise. This is what happened to Adam and Eve. Living in the misery of conflict after his expulsion from Eden, he felt lonely in his hostile universe. He turns to his own mind, proud, ambitious, possessive, greedy, vengeful, aggressive, and confused as it was, his Mephistopheles, for succor in his battle with life. He was quite ignorant of the fact that the talking mind, the thinker and his thought, was now the slave of the pleasure principle. And worse still, he could not see that the pleasure principle was in fact the pleasure-pain principle. This is something which right up to our own times, extremely few people, you can practically count them out of the 5 billions in the world, who understand this, that the pleasure principle and the pursuit of the pleasure principle always means the pursuit of the dual pleasure-pain complex. Because when pleasure ends, there is the craving, the tanha, for the repetition of that pleasure. And that pleasure, as and when it cannot be repeated, causes misery and many other things too. This dark mind, carrying time's heavy burden of the accumulated memories of our age-long past, is the noise-maker in the world, the sorrow-maintainer. It insulates us from the silence of heaven's own music. Heaven's music is the music that one's ears do not hear. It's a silent music, but it is music in the pure sense because it is perfect harmony. The harmony of the whole psychophysical organism, the body and the psyche, is a unity. And that unity functions and lives like a song. Therefore, it's heaven's music. And all these memories and conflicts and sorrow are built into our very nerves and brain and our whole organism. They constitute our conditioning by natural evolution. They are part of our living heritage transmitted through uncounted ages. See, there are these two great conditioning factors. Evolution, natural evolution, is a conditioning factor. And our social code, our social business and other moralities and so forth. They are conditioning factors. See, when we are born, we say we are born free. That is true in actual fact. But the little infant which is born free, this infant begins to be conditioned from the moment of birth onwards. And this is the result of organized society and the ways of life laid down by organized society. This does not mean that organized society and its ways must be destroyed or discarded, not at all. Then you have confusion worse confounded. There'll be complete chaos. It has to be so. One has to go through the imprisoning in order to learn how to live, that we disimprison ourselves and understand the true meaning of freedom. I have often said at our meetings here, freedom begins at the peak point of self-restraint. Now, of course, self-restraint is very different from the restraint put upon us by family, friends, society, teachers, and all the rest of it. It's very different. Self-restraint emerges, and how will you recognize self-restraint? When you are thinking and feeling certain thoughts and feelings, or saying certain words and doing certain things, you see for yourself your own nous makes you see that this is unnecessary. It is not wanted really. Then it naturally falls off you. You don't have to fight against it. As long as we fight against the evil in ourselves, we strengthen it. It's a curious thing, but it is so. You know, Edward Carpenter, I think, was the man who wrote a book which I read during my school days. And I was tremendously impressed by a little story he wrote in it of a person who was struggling with his enemy and trying to get the better of him. And the more he struggled, the more he threw him down, the stronger did the enemy become. Of course, as a child, I poo-pooed that idea, because what can an immature little child do but poo-poo such an idea? You see? But it is true. That is what happens. Because what we are struggling against is not an other, a something else. It is our own self. Only we are unaware that it is our own self. When we become aware that it is our own self, we become knowledgeable as regards what the true self is. The true self is the one and only self, the totality. That is the true self. And then, when we see things that way, that so and so is unnecessary and it drops off, then we become self-responsible. In actual fact, we would like to be self-responsible. But how many of us are? And to what extent are we capable of being self-responsible? See, practically none of us know in full the meaning of self. The self is just the one self that there is, the totality. The one total reality is the only self. But the one total reality, because it manifests itself in a particular way, appears to us to be composed of countless, multitudinous, separate items. That is, it is because we are conscious in our limited way that we see everything in the universe as other than oneself. When that comes to an end, and it can come to an end, and it has been proved that it can come to an end because there have been perfected holy ones for thousands of years. When that comes to an end, then you are the one and only self. Is it surprising that the great Upanishadic holy ones said, "Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, the totality, the absolute all." And that realization is the peak point of the whole of yoga, the practice of yoga. Do realize the physical fitness part of yoga is necessary as physical fitness, a special type of physical fitness. The type of physical fitness which will enable brain and nerves, and therefore and the whole body, the bloodstream, the ductus glands and all, so to function that psyche will be clean and pure. That is how and why I think, anyway. I may be wrong, but I do think that is how it is. That is how and why the asanas and pranayama were invented. And mind you, they came into being rather a long time ago, long time for us, a good 5,000 years at least, because, you know, when the Indus Valley civilization was being investigated and they discovered that particular little thing which was a representation of Shiva in a meditative pose. So they must have known yoga, in a yogic posture, actually, you see. So they must have known these things for a very, very long time. Now, life transcends our human failure, just as it transcends any and every success. What we consider success is really failure. Brahman is life, prana. That's what is said in the Chandogya Upanishad. The transcendent is life. The psychophysical organism is not merely what we know of it or imagine we know of it with our conscious minds. Its latent potentialities defeat the imagination. The development of these latent potentialities leads to what we are calling holistic consciousness, functioning in the context of the infinite and the eternal. And that is only part of the whole story. There are grades and grades of being and development which are transcendent to what I can conceive of as transcendent. It's unending. You see, we use the term absolute. We use the word ultimate. There is no ultimate in the sense of an end point. There is no end point. There is everlasting creation. Creation has not stopped. Nor will it stop. It will go on and on as far as we mortals with our time consciousness can see and talk of. So you see, there is no end. That is one of the reasons why the holy ones of the past, although the word the goal was used, knew that there was no goal in the sense of an end point. It goes on and on and on. And when you can put yourself in tune, in harmony, not just accept it as an idea in the sort of verbal formulation I have given it, but when you really can be in tune with it, then you will know peace in the real sense and harmony in your own inner being. See, if I had tried to write all this sort of thing when this book was written, this book would have been that fat. The organism which is named man is contained and wholly subsumed within the transcendent. The reality of the transcendent flashes into our life again and again, even as day dispels the darkness of night. But just as a man who refuses to come out of a deep underground cave remains in a rhythmless dark, so too he who curtains his eyes against the transcendent light. I deliberately wrote rhythmless dark because that dark can be everlasting. Time, like timelessness, is subsumed within eternity. But it is not the same as eternity. That we must realize. Eternity is not everlasting time. Time is continuously being born and dying. Birth, death, the continuity the unstoppable continuity of birth, death is time. But time has a rhythm to it. Similarly, that dark, that state of ignorance, also has a rhythm to it. But it is a rhythmless dark, a rhythm which is not creative. How separate an entity is each one of us? What substance is there to our egoistic misperception of our true being? Earth is mother. Sun is father. We are here by virtue of earth and sun and all that they have done for some 5,000 million years or so in order to bring us forth. And we have not only forgotten, but also we positively deny our undeniable factual relationship and oneness with our parents. How do we treat Mother Earth? We disembowel her to satisfy our greeds. Our Mother Earth bore us. She bears with us, though we spit upon her and stain her virgin purity by denying that we emerge out of her side. And when our little spark is cinder, she will silently enfold us again, totally, in her all-enduring, uncomplaining heart.